Well, this is WBAI in New York City. I'm not quite sure why that was queued up. That would have been Women, Body, and Soul. However, that's not what is scheduled to be on at this hour, at least not unless there was a memo that I didn't get. So, yeah. And even then, it would have been about 2 minutes early. So bear with us as we prepare for Hour of the Wolf coming your way in about a minute and a half. And let me see if I can find an appropriate minute and a half to play you. No, they don't seem to have one set there. This was certainly, looks like it was set up to run through, but it has happened many times before that staff get one memo saying when we are supposed to be on the air, and the ops crew get another memo saying what's going to be on. Just curious here. There's a browser open that shows the different programs, and let's take a look on the Wednesday schedule. Yeah, the Wednesday schedule says Hour of the Wolf, so no, there wasn't a memo or anything that I missed. This is as it should be. So do let me stress, however, that what has not changed is our being in a fundraising drive. Huh, are there any headphones around here? I like headphones when I'm on the air. There they are. And we urge you to give a call, as they were talking about from that vastly pre-recorded program that we just heard with Gary Null and Tony Bates. 516-620-3602, or going to give to WBAI.org. I know, by the way, that they stress the number 2 when they say things like that, but there's actually no need for that. If you type in GIVETOWBAI.org, it will get you to the right place where you can then become a WBAI buddy and make a donation on a monthly basis, as little as $5 a month. You know, we can do one of those things that's less than subway transportation for a day, round trip. $5 a month will make you a WBAI buddy. And be sure to credit Hour of the Wolf when you do that, huh? Okay, so for all of my complaining, I'm not yet set with my theme music. Now, why would that be? That would be because I was taken unawares, says I, on when the show was to begin. And that was about, a minute and a half ago. Time to howl. Thank you. And good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning we are going to hear the May Day edition of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. We have for you Alana C. Meyer and Joel.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I'm not sure what to say about Avengers Infinity War. That's not a bad thing, quite the opposite, actually. This may not be the best film this year, but it's going to be hard to top this in terms of just pure entertainment. And that's not a small order, given a 2.5-hour running time, a scenario that rallies most of the extended Marvel Cinematic Universe, including... And I'm going to try to be inclusive here, just so you understand the magnitude, but I may miss a few. Iron Man, Captain America, Spider-Man, Black Widow, the Guardians of the Galaxy, Vision, Doctor Strange, War Machine, Falcon, Scarlet Witch, Black Panther, White Lightning, no wait, that's Moonshine, sorry, The Hulk, The Winter Soldier, Ant-Man is referred to, but doesn't appear apparently because he's got his own deal in the summer. And that roster gets split up into something like 6 different storylines encompassing 4 or 5 locations in space, and God knows how many earthbound locations. And that's too much. By all rights, a construction like that shouldn't hold together, and I went into this dreading a bombastic, incoherent mess. You know, Justice League. That doesn't happen is something of a miracle. That the film is absorbing, entertaining, and surprisingly fleet-footed for its running time is frankly breathtaking. It's the equivalent of the pyramids crossed with McDonald's French fries, at once an awe-inspiring construction whose genesis defies explanation and a full-on commercial commodity that also happens to be the gold standard for its category. Credit goes to directors Anthony and Joe Russo, whose previous work on Captain America Civil War, specifically The Airport Clash, clearly served as a mini-audition for how you can bring an entire ensemble of super beings together and still keep the audience invested in the fate of the individual members. Credit also has to go to writers Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, who balance action, humor, drama, and cosmic consequences amazingly. The numerous special effects studios who have generated both terrestrial and extraterrestrial settings that are both epic and frequently flat-out beautiful, and editors Jeffrey Ford and Matthew Schmidt, who lead us through the parallel storylines without missing a beat or making us feel overwhelmed. And let me note one other amazing thing, and it involves a small plot spoiler, but not a disastrous one. One of my biggest bugaboos is when a film leaves us with an ellipsis, taking us only part way through a story confident, sometimes wrongly, that we will be committed enough to return a year or two later for the wrap-up. I'm looking at you, Hunger Games. Avengers Infinity War does end on an ellipsis, but does not short us on providing a complete journey. And the brilliant thing about that is that the Russo brothers, along with Marcus and McFeely, have decided that the journey we go on with this film is not with any of the heroes, but with the film's big bad, Thanos, a formidable megalomaniac bent on decimating literally half the universe. With a grounded and nuanced performance by Josh Brolin, even slathered over with performance capture CG, the character is every inch the madman the good guys keep calling him, yet a madman with a compelling rationale and a vulnerability that lends a modicum of tragedy to his acts, including one particularly horrific act that I won't describe here. So here it is. Avengers Infinity War tells a full, compelling story from an unexpected perspective, leaving us primed for the next and presumably concluding chapter, which fortunately we'll only have to wait a year for. Question I have is this. The film pretty much styles itself as the Marvel movie to end all Marvel movies. And it delivers. So what's left? We'll find out next year. I have my concerns, but the Russos parted the waters this time, so who knows what they're capable of in the follow-up. Also opening theatrically this Friday, April 11th, is Lou Over the Wall, an animated film from the very unique Japanese director Masaaki Yuasa. Styled as a modern read on The Little Mermaid about a young siren, Lou, who becomes smitten with the garage band of a small seaside town and, more specifically, its sullen teen drummer. There are in this film points where the crossover with Hayao Miyazaki's Ponyo feel too blatant, as well as points where it clearly diverges, specifically in a focus on how this contemporary town has fallen upon hard times economically. But what you're coming for is Yuasa's endlessly versatile animation style, and how the director changes palettes to fit the moment, letting characters who are at extreme emotional states lose all boundaries of their physical form, becoming fluid entities, envisioning flashbacks as childlike, impressionistic swatches of color, and at one point having the townsfolk, entranced by Lou's singing, begin to jitterbug in a way that wouldn't look out of place in a Tex Avery cartoon. The transitions can happen even in the context of a single scene. It's a singular kind of mirthful anarchy, and I dig it. Yuasa's work has been sneaking into America in unexpected ways. He guest-directed an episode of Adventure Time a few years ago, and his more adult-oriented mind game was the April Fool's quote-unquote joke on Adult Swim this year. But Lou Over the Wall is a kid-friendly way to discover his work. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
Okay, so, thank you, Dan. Interesting review. No, I am afraid, no, I'm just not that interested in the anime film on the grounds that, oh, it's anime, not my favorite form at all. This always provokes controversy, but I haven't seen an anime film that has done it for me yet. So, hey, Rick, how are you? Okay. Yeah, we talked earlier today, so I'm going to, Richard Bose is watching on Facebook. By the way, now Daniel's watching, now that we just finished his review. So let me address this to you, Daniel. Now, I have not seen, what is all that noise out there? I have not seen Infinity War yet. I'm going to see it Friday. Been waiting a little bit for crowds to die down to be able to reserve my seats at my preferred reservation-based movie theater, which doesn't have 3D, but that's okay by me. One thing that I should mention to you. Now Rick and Barbara can chat to each other. What was I going to say about Infinity War? Well, as I said, I haven't seen it. I'm going to see it Friday. Looking forward to it. I think Dan's point is very, very well taken. I seem to recall years ago when the this is the problem when I read the Facebook at the same time. I have to close my eyes because I also actually have Facebook in front of me at the same time. I know. I'll change the tab on my browser. And then I won't be seeing the comments when I'm trying to talk. Which point was I going to make? Okay, well, hey, Hank, how are you? Somebody asked, wait, isn't the point of reserving that you get your seat even if it's crowded? Well, yeah, that's part of it. But it also means that I get the seat of my choice, which is very important to me. I like the seats that I choose. I use who are longtime listeners to WBAI may remember the great late Paul Wonder, who had a formula for choosing what seat you should choose to watch a movie. And his answer was, it's a given that you want to be as dead center as possible. And you don't want to be in the first row because that will be more than your peripheral vision can handle. So you will be actually moving your head left and right. And if the director has something going on the sides of a screen, you will miss things. I mean, that would apply especially to, say, a Wes Anderson film like Isle of Dogs. But it's the answer is one screen length. So if a screen is, I don't know how big movie screens normally are. Yes, Deb, you would remember your cousin. Paul Wonder said, if the screen were, say, 50 feet wide, sit 50 feet back. And universally, this works. What that does is it fills your vision with the screen right up to the point of your peripheral vision. So your eyes will move, which ensures that you mentally engage with the film. It also means that you don't have to move your head and that you will see everything there is to be seen. So I choose those. Our listener who, good morning, Heather, our listener who made that, made that point about reserving seats in a movie theater, seat inside can be preferable to a center seat if the only one available is behind someone tall. At the movie theater of my choice, the seats are, there's about 5 feet in front of you in terms of legroom. This is because this is one of those theaters, I guess they call them diner theaters, as opposed to dinner theaters, because there's a table in front of you. And so there's plenty of room. So even if you have a very tall person in front of you, and because the raking, the angle of the seats is steep enough, a tall person in front of you will not block the entire thing. So that is a theory that I that width versus length of the theater theory, that is true. There was a time that I could have told you, name a major movie theater, and I could tell you what row to go to. Before, and I'm a stickler for choosing my seats. I go to off-time screenings. So, for example, when I see Infinity War this Friday, I had my choice between a 3:30 and a 4:30. I took 4:30 because it's too early for everybody to be out of work and going. So Yes, but if you slope the row of seats, you can get sick by bending over, and rotating the seat back is too expensive. So there we go. Okay, I'm breaking my rule. I wonder how many things I have not answered or not finished saying because I'm answering questions. Thus is the problem of paying attention both to Facebook Live and to the radio show. And it's the radio show that comes first. So first, let me just say that I would appreciate it during the show if you do pledge your support for WBAI. We are in a fundraising drive. And the telephone number is 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602. Or you can go to givetowbai.org and click your way, or just go to wbai.org and you can navigate your way through the various options there and choose to give a certain amount. Last week I was making requests for $51 because May 1st, and this will be a May 1st show. We are playing an event on May 1st. May 1st was my 51st anniversary of starting to volunteer here at WBAI, and the answer to the next question always has to be, I was 13 at the time. So, that's number one. Pledge, become a member, support listener-sponsored radio. Let us get to the content of the show. Oh, no, no, another announcement! Because this is going to be, you're going to hear an example of our most recent, just last week, the day before last week's 51st anniversary, my anniversary show. The anniversary program's been on the air now 45 years. I've been working here 51. Yeah, that's correct. So, so you can pledge $51 or you can become a WBAI buddy. And the day after that, don't you love it? You can, how you can hear the fax machine. Let me turn up some mics. You hear that? The fax machine in test mode. This is, it's not in this room, folks. This is just the soundproofing or the lack thereof that we have here at WBAI. Okay, so New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. That's an, it's not affiliated with WBAI. It's affiliated with me. It's a reading series that was started by Gordon Van Gilder. It is the oldest such series in the country, and we're darned proud of it. I've been working on the series since it began some 27-plus years ago as the recordist. But I've been the producer of the series now for well over a decade. And we've got a really good one coming up next month, June 5th, first Tuesday of the month. And it is a tribute to Thomas M. Dish. We do these tributes every so often off, and very often they are spurred on by the suggestion and the talent of Henry Wessels, and this case is no exception, and he has got an incredible lineup of people. There will be performance, there will be, which reminds me, I need to get a narrator for reading some of Tom Dish's work. There will be, Eric Solstein will be presenting a clip of this documentary he's been working on about Tom Dish for many, many years. And, oh, Liz Hand, John Clute, you see, I didn't want to start, Brendan C. Byrne, a fine, if not very famous writer, within, very well-known writer within the science fiction community. He's probably better known outside. Facts, says somebody, some Nebula, last year's Nebula Award nominee. I shouldn't say last year's Nebula Award. It's still au courant until the nebulas are held later this month. And we have one of this year's Nebula Award nominees on the live chat Rick Bowes. So pleased that Richard Bowes is nominated. And I'm going this Friday. Oh, wait a second. No, Monday. Next Monday, I will be recording an interview with Rick, because this Friday I'm going to see Infinity Wars, because, oh, it's complicated. I'll tell Rick about it. I won't bother you folk. Okay, this is what you need to do. Join us on Facebook Live. You can go to the WBAI radio page, the Hour of the Wolf page, or to my page, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and you can watch. You cannot, however, necessarily hear what will be on the radio, especially when my mic is open. And when it's not, we may very well be chatting to each other through Facebook, so that will not be the focus. What I suggest you do is open another tab on your computer if you are listening via computer, and go to WBAI.org and listen that way. Or, and this is the really bizarre idea, turn on a radio if you're in the New York area and tune in to 99.5 FM. And you can hear us that way. Okay, Jonathan in Canada says, my favorite house arrangement was at the Thalia, where the first few rows raked backwards away from the screen. I remember that. Oh, yeah. It's like being strapped into a barber's chair, perfect for horror films. I am well, Connie. How are you? So, enough of that until we get into the reading. Here is last month's reading. So, talking about June 5th, but instead we would suggest that you set your Wayback Machine to May 1st and prepare to hear two wonderful writers. Later on, we will have Jo Walton, that's just J-O, and she is a remarkable critic and poet. She is serious and she is funny. But first, as we often like to say, but first, the wonderfully talented Alana C. Meyer, whose second book came out a few weeks ago. Alana has worked as a journalist in Jerusalem and a cultural critic for various publications. As Alana Teitelbaum, she has written book reviews and critical essays for The Globe and Mail, the Los Angeles Review of Books, Salon, and The Huffington Post. Her first novel was Last Song Before Night, and the new novel is Fire Dance, and she lives in New York City. Uh-oh. And while I've been saying all this, my recording has been running. I have an audio recording that I was going to make play, but I found out that the video recording actually sounds a little better. So I brought that with me, and we are going to be listening to that as our sound source. So bear with us. And now, without any further ado, Alana C. Meyer.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming. As Jim was saying, my latest book, Fire Dance, is quite new. It came out, I think, 2 weeks ago. And it is a standalone sequel to my first novel, Last Song Before Night. Both books concern themselves with poets, except they also have access to magical powers. This book is kind of a combination of Celtic myth and Middle Eastern magic and flamenco. And what I'm going to do is read an excerpt, and it's going to be a little confusing at first, but I would like to just jump in and kind of let you get the hang of it as I go, if that's all right. They followed a melody through trees, a lonely tune picked out on a woodpipe, or it sounded lonely to Lynn. A harp was different, the strings keeping company with each other, a sound ethereal rather than plaintive. Melancholy, yes, but that was something else. Perhaps Valinir would have disputed this point, she thought, keeping Zahir in sight ahead of her, the gold of his sash. There were few absolute facts about their art, it was clear. Her own thoughts were often at odds with the academy. As if on her solitary path she had picked up other things, odd and random, like Bramble's cotton one's cloak on a walk through the wood. She trailed him through the gray dark of moonlight into the deeper dark of tree shadows, scented with orange blossoms. A nightingale's song carried on the breeze. They were in the imperial gardens, those which could be seen from the throne room. Even at sunset, Lynn had noticed there seemed no end to them. Upon entering now, Zahir had listened a moment, then said, "Ah," when the woodpipe was heard, and smiled. Then motioned that she follow him, down the garden path before swerving from it, into an unmarked wilderness of trees. He didn't explain, not about the music, nor the garden, nor the reason for coming here. It didn't matter. The alternative was the silence of her room and the dream. She would have agreed to almost anything. At one point, she did whisper, grabbing hold of his sleeve, "I feel as if I've been here." The scent was overwhelming in what it recalled to her, despite the memories not being hers, as was the construction of this garden, the way the sight lines teased, made you think you were coming to one thing, only to see another in its stead. Every angle you stood, the prospect changed dramatically. There was a pattern to this, and an art that was decipherable once you recognized it. Zahir stopped then. He bowed his head as if she'd told him something disquieting. Edrian Luttrell played in the court of Ramadas, he said, was welcomed as a guest there. Yusuf wanted his palace to resemble that court. The pipe had broken off a moment, but soon resumed. "Do you think he succeeded?" Lynn asked, recalling that Zahir had been in the court of Ramadas for a time. He thought a moment, then, "In some ways, but the Zahra, it is no copy of anything in the end. Whatever Yusuf might have wanted, it is itself." The tune of the woodpipe soared, became wild, neither happy nor sad, at a remove from both of these. For Zahir, it seemed a signal. He held out a hand to her. "Come." After a moment, she took his hand. It was roughened with a firm grip. So he was a fighting man. In bouts, she wore gauntlets to keep the palms of her hands smooth, as befit a court poet. They walked together. The warmth of his hand, after days without contact, a reminder of isolation. This and the refrain of the pipe twisted within her as they trod the grass. She breathed deep of the garden scents to clear her thoughts, to forget everything but this moment, since nothing around it, before or after, could be altered. Soon they heard not only the nightingale and the woodpipe, but the sound of falling water. She was not surprised when they stepped into a clearing and saw that the moon shone on a waterfall and beside it a stream. She was more surprised that she recognized the man who played music at the water's edge. He sat cross-legged on a blanket in the grass. Willows dug their roots into the bank. Their branches dipped to the water in curves, like a lady dropped in a curtsy. As they approached, Lynn disengaged from the first magician. She bowed to the man by the stream. He stopped playing, looked bemused. "No need for that here," said the king. "Sit with us." "In this garden, you drop formalities?" Eldekar's smile looked sweet to her and sad. "Here we become ourselves." Zahir knelt in the grass, then stretched full length beside the king, the back of his head cupped in his hands. He let out a long sigh and closed his eyes, as if, at long last, he was at rest. Almost absently, the king reached over and squeezed the other man's shoulder. Zahir raised himself on an elbow. "A long day," he said, looking up at Eldekar's face. "How are you?" "I am home," said Eldekar. "We, all of us, are home. For now, that is enough." He looked to Lynn. "Please make yourself comfortable," he said, indicating a spot on the blanket. "I swear to behave with every propriety, as will my friend." She smiled. A rash promise, she